Hello, I'm Tony Lidington. You're listening to a special programme for Radio 4 Extra, in which I'm delving into the sound archives and unearthing programme gems celebrating Britain's seaside entertainments. 4 Extra at the British Seaside. I'm here on the seafront in Brighton, just beneath the old remnants of the West Pier.
Fancy meeting you.
And I'm joined by Gavin Henderson, who grew up here in Brighton and whose first job was backstage on the Palace Pier, which has recently adopted the new name, the Brighton Pier. Anyway, Gavin went on to become, among other things, the principal of Trinity College of Music, and he's been president of the European Festivals Association, and for several years ran the Brighton Festival, which has been running now since 1967. In fact, I seem to remember you commissioning me to produce a show called The End of the Pier Show,
right.
Performed on the Palace Pier with me dressed as Max Miller. That's
yes,
right.
Yes.
But now you're the principal of the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama at the University of London, and honorary president of the National Peers Society. And it's great to see you here again. It's a while since we've met, I know. But tell us, what do you think is so important about peers?
Well, it's a kind of fantasy. I like to think that they're a classless structure, sort of republic of fun. When you went through the turnstiles, you went into another world completely, and it didn't sort of matter what your background was. Somehow you left everything behind, and it wasn't as dangerous as going abroad and all that funny food and other languages and things. It was something quite secure, very British in a way. And it when they were first built, of course, they were places of great style. We think of end-of-the-pier humour, and people say, oh, well, that's all very end-of-the-pier, isn't it? That's a relatively recent phenomenon, sort of post-war, really, post-last war. When they were first built in the mid-19th century, they were places to be seen in your best clothes, and the entertainments, which gradually, you know, started to come onto the piers, because they had to find more and more reasons to entice people onto the piers, they were quite classy things. I mean, the piers became sort of art centres, really. The West Pier was probably the finest of them all in that sense, because it had a pier pavilion at the end, which became the Pier Theatre, and then halfway down, built just after the First World War, was a purpose-built concert hall. So you had the kind of plays and performances that were going on in the theatre were opera seasons, seasons of Shakespeare, seasons of Bernard Shaw. I've got all the programmes, amazing, a whole Mrs. Patrick Campbell doing a week on the pier. Whilst that was going on, you had the orchestra, the Brighton Municipal Orchestra, playing halfway down the pier, not just light classics, but, you know, there's a story, Lyle Taylor, who conducted the orchestra, used to come on with an Alsatian dog that howled through the national anthem. But he would address the audience at the beginning of the week. This is a true story. He said, we're now going to give you the first performance of a new symphony by Mr. Havergal Brown. It's well above your head, so I propose to play it every day this week and twice on Saturdays. Can you imagine, you know, that doing Harrison Birtwistle today, getting something like that? But all that gives you a picture of a seaside pier, in a sense, far from the way in which we popularly sort of think of a pier today. But they've gone through all sorts of different guises in order just to sustain the structures, really.
So it's almost like an extension of the seaside itself, because presumably people came to the seaside where they could abandon their usual identities. They could play at a whole variety of different entertainments. And
well, no, you see, that's very Brighton. You come down to Brighton as a town built on misbehaviour, really. That's what it's all about. Whereas in the Wakes weeks up north, Morecambe, Blackpool and so forth, you didn't go to it. You went with your workmates. The factories closed down and everybody went to, you know, that particular... Bradford people all went to Morecambe. Manchester people went to Blackpool. So you had the sort of security of being actually very much still with the people you were working with. Not much escape there. Brighton, very different.
But recently, piers have fallen on pretty hard times and there's lots of them have suffered.
They're difficult structures to maintain. They're expensive. And I suppose through the sort of 70s, the health craze hadn't started. Now all the fitness freaks, of course, peers should be coming back into their own, bracing walks along them, you know. But they went through a period where the cheapest way of maintaining attractions, if you like, were slot machines. And so most of the theatres and these wonderful pavilions that were built on the piers are now really amusement arcades. There are very few theatres left. I mean, the prime example of a pier sustaining a traditional seaside show is at Cromer.
And do you think it's likely to rediscover that function as being somewhere?
I think it could. I mean, whether it will or not, it should, shall we say. I mean, in Sydney Harbour, they're not pleasure piers, they're terminals for shipping, if you like. But there's a particular pier there, which is home to the Sydney Theatre Company, and that has become very much a kind of art centre. And I think a time might come where that sort of style returns to the seaside.
And certainly you see it here in places like, I don't know, Cardiff and the kind of marina-type spaces, yes, where people are building onto promontories and having restaurants,
yes,
and places, viewing points, and places where you can take a pleasure cruise,
yes,
to somewhere or other. So I see it as being possible. But here in Brighton, they're obviously planning on having a kind of large perpendicular structure.
Well, so they're referring to it as a vertical pier, aren't they, really?
They are, exactly. I'm not sure you can walk up it.
Slide down it, maybe.
Bracing in a different,
yes,
sort of way.
Yes.
Gavin, you've had a wide and varied career now, but you've always come back to Brighton. What is it that haunts
you? I've never left Brighton. I've always had a route here, one sort or another. I was born here. I've lived here all my life, but I work elsewhere, and I have sort of toeholds elsewhere. But Brighton is home. Absolutely. And I, growing up in Brighton, I just sort of imagined that everybody grew up in a place like this, you see. I mean, my paper round, I had Laurence Olivier and Joan Plowright, Terence Rattigan, Dora Bryan, Flora Robson, John Clements and Max Miller.
Full set.
I just thought everybody, you know, had people like that on their paper rounds. You know? But it was the sort of liberal spirit of Brighton, I think, as well. That it was and is an extraordinary lively place that artists and creative people are drawn to.
Gavin's just rushed back up to London, and now I'm joined by Rachel Clark, who's the chief executive of the West Pier Trust. Nice to see you.
Hi.
So we're standing here beneath what remains of the West Pier, and you're the chief executive of the West Pier Trust. So what exactly does that trust do? Why was it set up?
Well, originally it was set up with the hope of restoring the pier and getting it back into public use. That was a long time ago. What happened then was, well, there was a series of attempts, and then finally the National Lottery was created, and a period of years passed when we made a lottery bid and finally were successful in that. And the restoration was about to begin in 2003 when the pier was burnt down. The lottery fund decided to withdraw its funding, and the West Pier Trust was left with no pier and no funding. And it was at that point that we were approached by the creators of the London Eye. And they had a new idea for a new observation attraction, which is known as the I-360. And were we interested, it would be sited on the route end of the pier, so not going out to sea, just on the landward side. We were very interested. It's a beautiful design, elegant and entirely appropriate for the site, because as we saw it, well, there's lots of advantages to it, but the main one was that it was like a 21st century interpretation of a pier. It was a vertical rather than a horizontal pier. It had all the same attractions that the West Pier would have had in the late 19th century. But also, of course, having the I-360 wouldn't preclude eventually having a new pier as well. So it was the best of all worlds, we thought. It was greeted enthusiastically by the city, and planning permission was gained in late 2006. And then, of course, the economy slowed and ground to a halt in about 2 years later, which has meant that it's been very, very difficult to get all the funding in place in order to start building. We're almost there, and we expect the I-360 to start construction on site very soon. There's lots and lots of preparations being done already, and it's almost ready to go.
And in the meantime, there's the kind of skeletal structures of the West Pier here, and there's, you know, these stanchions on the beach, but behind us here, there's various artefacts, presumably collected from the sea and all around. What's the plan for all that's left of this?
So far as the artefacts which are held in storage under the route end of the pier, a couple of years ago, we invited the public to buy some of this material, and it was immensely popular. We raised some significant funds, all of which is designated for heritage and educational use. Some of it already is going towards our education programme, which we do in partnership with the fishing museum further down the beach. What remains of the pier, which is in itself has become a sort of iconic monument in Brighton, and you never see a photograph in the press of Brighton Beach which doesn't include a picture of the remains of the West Pier. It is an inspiration to a huge range of people. I mean, I get approached by people of all different ages who have used it as a source of inspiration for art, for music, written word. It's amazing. So we have no intention to remove the skeleton of the pier. We hope it has a future in some form or other once the I-360 is delivered. It's not a very easy project. People describe it as a roller coaster ride, and, you know, there's quite a few downs, I can tell you. You know, we've had a lot of bad luck. But people stick with it. It's not just me. You know, maybe the tenacity of the pier itself, the fact that it's still standing after all these years, that engenders a tenacity in the people who get involved. I don't know, but it's irresistible.
Good luck in all your efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
In 2005, I presented an archive hour for Radio 4 called Oh, What a Lovely Pier, produced by Angela Hind. It gathered together recollections and memories from people who love that pier, as I do. It's always been my muse, a metaphor of mankind's canute-like obsession with defying the elements, yet combined with such delicacy and pioneering engineering skill as to make its filigree structure appear to float on air. Let's listen again to Oh, What a Lovely Pier, back in 2005.
I'm sat perched on one of the original iron piles of the West Pier here in Brighton, driven and screwed into the mud, sand and rock below the shingle beach. The waves are rushing up and sucking back along the shoreline, and 100 yards out to sea there is the rusting, mangled hulk of the once magnificent West Pier. I lived for 10 years in Brighton, always within earshot of the rushing, sucking tide and a stone's throw from the stony beach. The West Pier was my inspiration then, despite the fact that she'd been closed to the public for a decade already by the time I arrived here. In those days, she was rather less dilapidated than she is now. She's a grand spectral relic of the dreams, vision and gaiety of a former age, like an old lady dowager, simultaneously representing decadence and neglect. She's the Miss Havisham of the sea.
It's a physical shock every time I see the thing in this sort of state. It's so sad that it's come to this, really, that it was such a majestic structure. Even as it sort of declined in recent years, it was clearly the queen of piers. And so it leaves me terribly sad to see it like this. And I think that, in a way, it's now time to try and move on and try and do something instead of this pier, rather than to have this as a memorial to collective failure, which is what it stands as at the moment.
There's no finer example of Britishness than this stubborn, elegant hulk of a vision, still standing defiantly against the sea. Well, just. The rotting West Pier provided the name for my Piero troupe, the Pier Rotters, with whom I've performed on, by, round, and even in the water alongside the West Pier. I'm not alone in adopting the West Pier as muse and inspiration. She's marked out many other admirers and acolytes. I'm making this programme about why the West Pier is so special and why this queen of piers has so many lovers like me.
We just loved it on there. It was a different type of person on there. It wasn't people with kiss me quick on their hats sort of thing. It was lots of actors on there, and it was just really nice.
The West Pier was the promenade pier where people used to come to sit in the sun, and residents, of course, preferred this pier, and the anglers liked it. It was a quieter venue, you know.
When the orchestra was playing, it used to come through all the loudspeakers, so everywhere on the pier you'd hear all this lovely music.
Well, it's a very pleasant place to go. You could sit down there, it was quiet. But then people, you see, the public who came on enjoyed it.
Well, happy days then.
All seaside architecture attempts to defy the elements in some way. But the seaside pier has got to be one of the greatest of all construction follies. It protrudes from the land, rests on the seabed, and yet floats in the air. Geoffrey Mead, former West Pier guide.
Here you were, suspended above the sea, perfectly safely, rough weather, no one got seasick. You know, it's a sensation of being part of the land, suspended in air, you know, seagulls flying below you, and also being out at sea. So it was a wonderful experience. We've lost all that, you know, that naivety has gone for us. We've all been up in jets, we've all done the big rides at Alton Towers. So, you know, the Victorians hadn't done this, and so it was novel and it was exciting and, you know, it was safely dangerous.
You know, I'm not sure that we have lost that sense of wonder and awe inspired by the West Pier. I know I certainly haven't. For a century, it has managed to stand resolute against an interminable cavalry charge of white horses, rocks and wind. The finest single example of British seaside architecture, the pride of Eugenius Birch, whose achievements should be as celebrated as those of Isambard Kingdom Brunel and Christopher Wren combined. Yet hardly anything is known about him. Even local historian and author Fred Gray found it difficult to discover very much.
Eugenius Birch is a wonderfully mysterious figure, and while we know he built lots of piers around the country, we don't have a single portrait or photograph or painting of him, so we don't know what he looked like or anything about him. Although John Lloyd, a former West Pier Trust person, did do some interesting research which implied that Birch, although in some ways a very respectable figure, also had a different life, and that almost certainly he fathered some children who were invented as his nephew and niece, and so one of those sort of classic Victorian respectable people who in fact had this other life.
He was the supreme pier builder. I think he was born in Stratford, and he went on to be a naval architect and design a whole series of harbours all around the country, and then piers all over the place at Deal and Plymouth and Aberystwyth. He went to school in Brighton, I think he went to Brighton College, and he would go out on the chain pier as a schoolboy. And we reckon he's got this love of piers from using the chain pier at Brighton, just about half a mile along the coast. But his greatest achievement was the Brighton West Pier, or the new Western Pier, as it was when it was being planned.
Birch's original drawings for the West Pier have been lost, though some of the later plans for the additional building still exist. They're in the safekeeping of structural engineers John Orrell and Partners in Hove.
Well, the original pier, as you can see from this drawing, had no buildings at all on it, just six kiosks. And what makes Brighton West Pier so special, of course, is that it was the first pier to be built purely as a pleasure pier, where people paid to go on and walk from one end to the other and see and be seen by the friends and other peoples in society, if you like. So as a result of that, there was only six small buildings or kiosks on there, which were vending outlets. I think two of them became toilets fairly quickly. That's the reason why the architecture was so strong, in that it was meant as a thing of beauty, like, as Oscar Wilde put it, all the pleasures of the sea cruise with none of the perils. Now, the pier was quite a success, so it was enlarged after 3 or 4 years. The central area was widened to make a resting place with benches and sunscreens. And then at the end of the 1800s, a big theatre was put on the end, or pavilion as it is now called, and that became a centre for many of the West End shows and was one of the best theatres in the land. You can see the theatre building shown there. Just at the end of the First World War, in about 1918, 1919, a concert hall was constructed in the middle, and that's where military bands used to play.
But those weren't Eugenius Birch's plans. His plan was just for the substructure?
The theatre was done by Peregrine Birch, I think a distant cousin, but the original deck was done by Eugenius Birch in 1866, and that was... He did several other piers all around the country and all constructed around about the 1860s, 70s.
And what was unique about what he did?
Two things, really. First of all, the use of screw piles in this sort of situation, which, although they were used following that, this is the first major pier, I believe, they were used in. And secondly, it was the architectural detailing of the pier, and that was fundamentally the most important thing, because all the structure that was visible with the eye was given ornate castings and mouldings to make it a thing that was pleasing to the eye rather than just a utilitarian industrial structure.
When this pier was built in 1863 to 1866, it's like the height of Victorian engineering, and it was seen as one of those great triumphs. You know, like the railway system was virtually complete, and we'd done these wonderful road bridges and railway bridges. And this is just another aspect of Victorian engineering, but applied to leisure purposes. It was a revolutionary method, this screw pile. It'd been used by the Navy before, but never in civilian applications, and Eugenius Birch took this. And what always knocks me out on this is that when you stand on the beach and you look along the line of the pilings, they're absolutely dead straight in line out as to the end of the pier. And yet these were all screwed in on a moving barge on the sea with a slot down the middle of the barge, and they would drop the pile through the hole in the barge, and it was wound in like a corkscrew. And this was done from a platform with sheer muscle power on a moving boat at sea. And yet, if you look at them now, they're all perfectly perpendicular and in line. And I have no notion of how they achieved that.
Well, if we stand along here, you can see that the piles are in virtually perfect line. And if we look at our more modern piles, you'll see that they're no better. In fact, if we measure them, we find out they were slightly worse.
And they were all driven in by hand?
Well, it was over 150 years ago, so we can't say exactly, but we feel there was an element of mechanical assistance, certainly to sling the piles in, to make a very rudimentary or simple crane. And from that crane, they may have hung a weight, which they pulled up and released to hit it like a giant hammer. We've also seen very early pictures of a hollowed-out keelway in the middle of a barge with a sailor's capstan on top to turn round the piles. My feeling is that it was a combination of turning and hitting that got the piles in.
Twist and bash.
That's it.
You would have thought that iron and wood would be no match for the constant coruscating swirl of natural things. But Birch's innovatory techniques resulted in a lasting monument to his ingenuity and imagination, both architecturally and culturally. Brian Spielman noted that the new pier even provided ramps in an effort to make the attraction truly accessible.
It was the first pier to have maintenance platforms. You see, he thought of that. I mean, they were wooden things, not the modern metal things, but that was all sort of part of the thinking. And beautiful ramps, you see, bath chair and perambulators also, catering for the children too. Yes, indeed. And, of course, when it was opened, the first person to sort of go on was in a wheelchair, was pushed by the mayor down on his wheelchair. Yes.
On the 6th of October, 1866, the West Pier opened to brass bands, a firework display, a 21-gun salute and, of course, a speech from the mayor. The fantasy of its architecture, combined with the functionalism and ingenuity of its engineering, made the new West Pier a modern-day marvel. A strong, delicate filigree structure over 1,000 feet long, painted silver and green, that sparkled like the brightest gem of old ocean's bauble, as Brighton was known. People flocked to it from that moment on. Now, all that remains is the crumpled, skeletal structure out in the sea, and an Aladdin's cave of rescued treasures underneath the landward end. Geoffrey Lockwood is chief executive of the West Pier Trust.
Wow. Well, we're under the pier now, and this is the compound, and it's full of bird poo and rusting iron. And this is what's left of the pier?
This is what's left of the pier. This is an area of about almost 50 yards by 50 yards. Virtually fully covered with the artifacts, stored artifacts from the old West Pier.
It's terribly atmospheric because it's got all these rusting hulks, but we can hear the sea booming behind us, and there's pigeons making their home in here and seagulls going around. It's, and now we can hear the sucking on the shore as well. It's quite sad. Show us around.
Yeah.
Is this decking?
Yes, this is old decking.
Right.
These are the cast iron bottoms of the old pavilion with the pillars sustaining the walls.
And the pavilion was the structure
at the far end.
No,
the far end. The concert hall was the one closest to it.
I remember always used to have military bands in there. They were damn good military bands in those days when military bands would be around, you know, like on the bandstand at Hove Front. And you could actually also have tea, if I remember correctly, because I listened to various concerts. But it was a great place, and it was always the smell of the sort of creosote on the planking. It was a lovely sort of smell. It was all, you know, rather sedate and genteel.
Over there is an 1866 dismantled kiosk in its entirety, just taken down and recorded every bit of it, so that we can authentically put back an 1866 kiosk, as well as using it to copy it for design purposes.
I don't think I've ever seen cast iron with quite so much detail in it. There's baubles and turnings and stars and shapes. I can see some myrmidons over there, the kind of goddess faces and godlike faces like you might see in an Art Nouveau painting or something. I'd see in a lot of theatres in plaster work and stucco work, but I've never seen it in iron before, certainly not in this quantity.
In the 1860s, the Victorian engineers loved this, working in iron in this way. Brighton set the tone for seaside architecture throughout the kingdom.
And was accessible to everyone. It wasn't solely private. It was designed to be enjoyed by everyone. This was a queen of piers. But it was for people to enjoy. It may have been privately owned, but actually it was for people to enjoy first and foremost. And now, of course, they've regenerated and rebuilt the pavilion for people to visit. It's our turn next day.
I hope so.
In 1901, another pier was opened in Brighton, the Palace Pier, just half a mile to the east. Now, rivalry has always existed between the Palace Pier and the West Pier throughout the 20th century, and it continues to this day. From the moment it opened in 1901, the Palace Pier was brash, racy and commercial, but the West Pier sought a different sort of clientele. Its concert hall aimed to present genteel music for up to 1,400 people, and it was known throughout the land for its own orchestra.
One of the great features of the concert hall in its early years, just after the First World War into the early 1920s, was the West Pier Orchestra. The West Pier Orchestra was conducted by someone called Lyle Taylor, a very famous conductor of the times who eventually went off to South Africa. He had long white flowing hair, used to take his sheepdog into the concert hall with him. If people came in late, he'd stop the orchestra and shout out and tell people to sit down. Perhaps the key figure in the West Pier Orchestra was Albert Cattelby, and he became famous not simply on the West Pier but throughout Britain and indeed the British Empire for a whole series of musical pieces which really transported people to other lands. So there's that wonderful In a Persian Market, a brilliant, wonderful piece, In a Monastery Garden, In the Mystic Land of Egypt, a whole series of other pieces. I think what that West Pier music was doing, not simply on the West Pier, but piers all over the country, was transporting people from English seaside towns to other parts of the world. Piers have always been good at transporting people elsewhere.
People go on there to see and be seen, to take the airs. It's health-giving. You could meet people on the pier without the normal restraints of Victorian England. That's one of the points about the pier, was that young ladies could go on a pier unchaperoned.
Why was it different from being on land?
Because resorts are at the edge, and edges are dangerous, and this is the edge of the land and the sea, and you're beyond the edge when you're on the pier. The shackles are off a bit when you come to a resort, and if you go onto a pier, you're further away still, and you could promenade, and that was seen as socially acceptable, but you were able to almost like move socially ahead. You didn't need all the constraints of a London drawing room. There were no visiting cards, very few aged aunts, and it was very much a liberating thing. Of course, when you came off the pier, social conventions applied, as much as they did in Brighton, and then when you went back to London, of course, the restrictions were fully on. So the early stage of a pier is the promenade, health-giving, and it's adventure for Victorians.
Later on, the concert hall was also a regular venue for some of the BBC's outside broadcasts.
Well, anyone who knows Brighton will bear me out in saying that there's always a good band on the West Pier. And now here's one of your favourites, Don Rico and his band of gypsies. All the girls looking romantic in their Romani costumes, their gaily coloured scarves, and can they play? Listen now to a typical fiery Spanish dance, Andalucia.
My name is Nick Nissen. I was violinist with Gian Ralphini and his band, and we played here every summer. Used to come for a week at a time, played on this concert hall. We used to love it. It was great. It was like going to the Palladium after all the others, you know. It was enclosed, so it didn't matter what the weather was like. We had our regular fans used to come in every day. It was always full.
Paddle steamers were a great joy. The whole of the pier head was sort of surrounded at a lower level by these landing stages which went right round the pier, almost like a crown round somebody's head, if you like. It sort of circled the pier where the paddle steamers could moor, and it could accommodate three paddle steamers at once if they happened to come along. And what was great fun was, we used to love watching this, when we had the very high tides, as it was moored up, it would be facing the land, it would cast off, and it would head in towards the shore and cut round very sharply. So it was almost, if you were on the beach, you felt you could have thrown a tennis ball at it and hit it. I remember each week they would paste up on various boards all along the front what the sailings for the week were. I mean, there were short sailings. You could go for an afternoon sail, which might just take you around sort of round about Worthing and back. Or then there would be longer ones, which would go to, I think, they would go to Southampton, and probably in Bognor and places along the coast. And then once a week on Fridays, it only cost £1, and on Fridays you could go to France for the day and back.
Teacher and social historian Jackie Marsh Hobbs has been collecting West Pier memorabilia for many years. It was more than just music and paddle steamers that attracted the 2 million visitors a year.
This is what made the West Pier really lovely and quite unique, I think, is that little bay at the end. They would call it the West Pier Bay. And right from the beginning, when the bay was there, they had people from the swimming club, the Brighton Swimming Club, doing demonstrations on swimming, because you couldn't, at that time, people were used to going in the sea and being dipped, or just, you know, but not swimming. And so they would give demonstrations on how you could swim and diving in. And then you got these experienced divers that would do very dangerous things at the end of the pier. And I'll find any pictures here. This one is what's called a sack dive. And that is actually a person in a sack diving into the sea. So very, very dangerous, because they'd have to then emerge from the sack and then come up. But the most popular dives, and the ones that were the crowd pullers, are the bicycle dives. For some reason, they would be called Professor. So Professor Cyril, Professor Reddish, Professor Palsy. And they had ramps that were sort of put at the end of the pier going into this bay area. And they would just cycle off and then land in the sea. And on some of the postcards, when you look at them, you can see a little rowing boat sort of stuck in the corner of the bay, so ready to come and rescue them and get the bike in.
Turf wars have always raged in the murky underbelly of Brighton's more seamy side. So Graham Greene's brooding razor gangland of Brighton Rock, or the 1960s confrontations between mods and rockers immortalised in The Who's Quadrophenia, are fictional representations of very real struggles for survival and dominance in the town. The rivalry between the two Brighton peers was no less intense. Each sought to outdo the other as the premier attraction of the town. They would announce new amenities and facilities to entice the public and enhance their own image. The West Pier created a flexible space in its concert hall, capable of being turned into a ballroom or even a roller skating rink. It converted its pierhead pavilion into a 1,000-seat theatre and presented plays, pantomimes and musicals throughout the year. In 1935, No No Nanette broke all box office records. The West Pier had some more populist entertainers too, such as Jack Shepherd's Entertainers, who were a concert party Piero troupe, who'd more usually be found performing outdoors on the beach, or al fresco, just as my troupe, the Pier Otters, does to this day.
Well, here we are, everybody, at Jack Shepherd's concert party, one of the most famous entertainments in the town. Unfortunately, the weather's not too good. Mr. Shepherd and his party usually perform al fresco in the open air. But tonight, it is a case of if wet in the hall opposite the rose. And here we are in the hall opposite, all ready for an ensemble entitled The Best of Friends, right on the floor.
My name is April Hennebury, and my father was manager of the West Pier. He first went to work on the pier in 1897 as a cashier, and 7 years later he became manager. So the pier played a large part in my life, especially before the war. And those were the lovely days with the repertory company playing in the theatre all through the summer and all the different shows that were on tour coming to the theatre. It was always an Andrew Melville pantomime. And Lydia Kirsch and her Russian ballet used to come. And of course the local amateurs used sometimes to use it. Also local dancing schools.
We did this dancing display on the West Pier, The Ugly Duckling. Of course, I was a duck. I was too fat to be a fairy, unfortunately. And all the ducks had to be pushed on in a huge egg onto the stage. But when it came to the point, I sat there absolutely petrified. And when they opened the egg, there were 11 screaming ducks. They're all terrified, being shut in.
What I remember about that theatre was, a lovely theatre it was, and the staff, they'd all been there about 25 years, and they were far more the bosses than we were. We had to go to them and sort of say, would you please do this and would you please do that? But I used to get on very well with them, and I remember my first part was of an Irishman, and one of the stagehands, I was very touched by this, and he came and coached me in the Irish and told me afterwards I was terribly nervous, of course, how well he thought I'd done it. And now the poor old pier, oh dear, I have a pang every time I go by it. Of course, the theatre went during the war and they made slot machines and the rest. But that was a great theatre and I had wonderful times there.
Closing of places of entertainment. All cinemas, theatres...
The pier was closed in 1940, just as almost every other seaside pier was, for fear of a German invasion force using them as landing platforms. 60 feet of deck and substructure were blown up, and then the pier was packed with mines and explosives just in case. In 1943, when the threat of invasion receded, the ordnance needed to be removed. That was a thankless task, performed by Ken Revis.
I suppose I had done possibly 8, 9, 10 mines, which in this case they were just under the decking. The thing was to get across this long gap on this sort of pulley thing, you see. And I had a bit of a plan with little blue spots marked on it and also on the deck of the pier, where somebody, whoever laid those mines, had put a tiny blue spot, which had a bit faded by then, but I had some idea where the mines were. I was attempting to reach the next mine, and in fact I had just said to my corporal, I said, "Corporal, this is money for old rope." I sort of stretched my back because I'd been kneeling, and at that moment up she went.
Ken lost both his eyes in that explosion. After the war, the pier was reconnected. But the connection with the summer trippers had been disrupted. The seaside was no longer associated with carefree holidays, fun and frolics, but barbed wire, austerity and fear. And the West Pier's pre-war glamour, splendour and innocence were never quite regained. However, in 1968, Richard Attenborough gave the pier a fresh lick of paint for a film, ironically entitled Oh, What a Lovely War. And this brought a whole new interest in the pier and its history. Corin Redgrave remembers it as a very happy time.
We did indeed use the theatre, we used the concert hall. I think we used every single part of the pier. It was hired by the film company for the duration of making the film, so I'm not sure what state it was in when they hired it, and of course they did a lot of work to make it look spick and span and make it look like a 1914 pier. And the whole film virtually was shot on that pier, and it looked lovely. It was beautifully painted, and it was beautifully designed, and of course it lent itself perfectly to the main idea of the film, which was make it an end of pier story. So it looked wonderful then. It was a very, very happy working atmosphere. It was both a holiday and a learning experience, an immensely happy time. I've been back many times to Brighton subsequently, and it's very sad to see the collapse of the pier and to see it about to fall into the sea unless something's done to rescue it, and I hope to goodness something will.
Although the pier started to lose its cultural profile, it remained a source of inspiration for artists and visionaries throughout the 60s and 70s. Gavin Henderson, who later became director of the Brighton Festival, remembers the part it played in the festival's early years.
1967, the first Brighton Festival, and Ian Hunter's view, he was the founding director, was that the piers should play a great part. You know, they should be symbolic of Brighton. He'd come from Bath, where he'd been running sort of the Baroque music there with Yehudi Menuhin, but he wanted the Brighton Festival to be very much a child of the 60s and a kind of frothy, fizzy event. And the piers were very much a part of those very early festivals, and the West Pier in particular. All sorts of strange and wonderful things happened, and they were, you know, for those of us who were young and growing up and sort of artistically minded in the town, they were revelatory. There was a group from France, Lazerie Bachet, Les Structures Sonores, which were sort of sculptures that you stroked and they make wonderful sounds. And a number of projects of that kind happened in this festival pavilion. It was very much the sort of social hub of the festival and late night performances and things. And then in 69, I think it was, I became a sort of helping with the festival as a gopher and sort of general stage manager and errand boy. And the Music Theatre Ensemble premiered the very first opera by Harrison Birtwistle. I was there when it was being rehearsed, again late into the night, and John Cox was the director, and two old chaps came in at the back and were talking away. And Harry Birtwistle, the then young Harry Birtwistle, turned around and said, "Why don't you two belt up? You know, we're trying to rehearse here. Have you got the rest of the pier to go out and talk on? You know, just shut up and clear off, will you?" And then he said, "Something made me turn round," he said, and I looked at them and I thought, "I know those things." And it was Laurence Olivier and William Walton.
It was the railways that took hundreds of thousands of trippers to the seaside in the mid-19th century. The urban working classes had statutory holidays for the first time, and also spare cash. The seasides, Brighton amongst them, were the workers' playgrounds, where anything was possible, and everything shimmered with excitement and exoticism. The late Brian Spielman of the West Pier Trust adored Brighton.
There's nowhere else like it. Nowhere else like it at all. It's got everything. It's got a slightly continental flavour. It's got every kind of person and amenity. It's got a marina, it's got theatres, it's got bookshops, it's got museums, it's got lovely architecture, fascinating. It's got the Sussex Downs, and it's got a marvellous mixture of good taste and vulgarity. It's got one of the most beautiful vulgar buildings in the world. And it caters for all pleasures, and it's dedicated to joy. And I think this is marvellous.
Somewhere beyond the sea. The most dazzling Brighton bauble of them all was the West Pier. In its heyday, it epitomised the glamorous, classless, aspirational vision of the seaside holiday, where the dull drudgery of working life could be abandoned along with one's inhibitions at the water's edge. All manner of exotic attractions could be found on the pier. Crazy mirrors, racing cars, bird warblers, ant exhibits, autogolf, phonodiscs, waxworks, palmistry, and even a pier tickler. Don't ask. Peter and Shirley Marsh used to own a fishing tackle shop on the pier in the 1950s.
After the war, Brighton was very, very popular. People had nowhere else to go but England. You used to have loads of people staying in the hotels, and they were the people who used to come on the pier. And, I mean, holiday times, it was unbelievable. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of people. And at the end of the first season, I bought the fishing tackle shop there and stayed there for the next 12 years. We sold fishing tackle and bait and hired rods out. And the fishing was, I mean, amazing. I mean, the size of the catch, the size of the actual fish is something that nobody's seen for many years. You know, really big plaice, 2 or 3 pounds, and Dover soles and pollock and bass and big black bream and things that you don't get today.
One of the nice things about the pier was you used to see shoals of porpoise, were they?
Oh, porpoises, yes.
You never see them now. You never see them, do you? And you used to see a whole load of them all sort of leaping out of the water, beautiful.
One day, and I don't suppose there's ever been one since, we had a basking shark, which is about 30 feet long. Enormous thing. Laying there with all this crusted with barnacles, because they're quite harmless, they only eat plankton. And there was a chap swimming, had swum out, and all these anglers on the lower deck were waving and gesticulating to him about this shark. And of course, there was this enormous dorsal fin. And I mean, that chap with big feet in Australia, he wouldn't have stood a chance against this bloke. He was on the beach in about 10 seconds. There were two amusement arcades. As you came on, you had the racetrack. We didn't have a bumper car as such. It was petrol or two-stroke, I seem to remember.
Like the go-karts.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And then underneath that was the amusement arcade, which was the ghost train and, of course, machines, you know.
A big weighing machine that you set on and they weighed
jockey
you.
Weights or something.
And then the candy floss and toffee apple kiosks all along there. And then people demonstrating and selling things that you don't get nowadays, do you?
Yeah. Then you had the rifle range underneath, where you shot two rifles. The offices were upstairs. Mrs. Hyatt, she had the bingo. Then at the end we had the Richaud collection. He was a pal of mine. He had a proper, like a commissionaire, used to stand outside. It was models.
It was a cardboard cutout thing of Jiving Judy. He'd stand it there and she'd start jiving and dancing about all by herself, no strings or anything. And of course he'd have a whole crowd all standing around watching and they'd all buy one. They're very cheap, but he'd sell loads of them and they'd go off. And Taffy, this little man, used to be in the cupboard thing at the side. And when he wanted him to dance, Roy Cow would had a hook on the back of it, and he'd sort of just hook it on this nylon thing and say, "Dance, Judy." And she'd start dancing. And it was the man at the back pulling the string. And certain times in the day when the sun was in the right position, it would light up this line and he couldn't open the shop then. He had to wait for the sun to move around.
The post-war boom in seaside holidaymaking didn't last long. Holiday camps, caravans and package holidays competed for a share in the holiday market in the 1960s and 70s. Nevertheless, from 1964, Alan Gale chose the West Pier as the venue for his old-time music hall. His son is the actor Peter Duncan.
He happened to be down in Brighton and came across the West Pier and saw the concert hall in the middle. And it was really what you'd call a white elephant. The pier was in decline and the bottom part of it was pretty even derelict then, and nothing went on in there. And this concert hall bit in the middle was never used. And he went to the people that owned it and he said, "Can I try a show in there?" And it was very successful. It was an old Thai musical show with a chairman, and they used to have what they call concerteds, groups of people singing, and my mum was in it. She was a soprano. My dad was what they call a light comedian.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
He used to tell very bad jokes.
Music hall on the West Pier, Brighton, on this beautiful evening.
He used to sort of try and hire a celebrity chairman every year. And Fred Stone did it, and Billy Milton, very famous entertainer, he did it. Bill Pertwee did it, and part of the chairman's routine was that they'd have to drink a lot of beer. This is a bit of a scam, you know. If you could drink as much beer as the chairman, you were better than him. But he used to have a trick glass, and he used to have a glass inside a glass, and you just used to fill up the gap. So it looked like he was drinking a pint of beer, and he'd have seven or eight a show. The show would stop, and out would come a waiter. The chairman would down it in 10 and belch and say, an echo from the Valley of Content.
Mary swallowed her wristlet watch just on the stroke of 9, then drank a bottle of castor oil to pass away the time. The castor oil, it did not work, the watch she could not pass. Now when she wants to know the time, she's got to look up to the clock on the mantelpiece.
When I was asked to do a season there in 1966 with Alan Gale, it all started off in a very strange way because Alan got onto my agent and I was living in the town, you know, and offered a rather small sum of money. My agent said, oh, I'll have a word with him. And he said, I tell you what, I'm going to ask him whether he'd like you to go on shares with him. So I said, OK. He said, well, you're living in the town. He said, you must make something. But he said, you never know, do you? But the thing was that quite early on, my wages worked out in 1 week on shares, £300. Now, that was pretty good in 1966. Alan was furious, absolutely furious. Alan used to pay out in pound notes on the pier outside the stage door, and it was a bit blowy, and he was a bit cross at me because he knew he'd got to pay me this sum of money again, and he was counting it out, and a wind got up and blew some of the pound notes away, and we were rushing about on the pier trying to grab these pound notes. He said, now see what you've made me do. Nothing to do with me at all.
The West Pier's rot set in long before its final closure to the public in September 1975. Costly seaside attractions, with huge upkeep costs such as piers or seaside fun parks, suffered in competition with Billy Butlin and Fred Pontin's all-inclusive utilitarian holiday experience, and of course the heat and exotic allure of foreign climes. There'd been little maintenance of the pier's substructure since the war, and the local council didn't see the pier as a social priority. It was bought by a local company, AVP Industries, in the hope of renovating and redeveloping it. And to do this, they proposed demolishing the pier head.
Well, what has happened is that because of neglect in the past, before we owned the pier, the underwater structure and the foundations have seriously decayed, and the cost of preserving it has become phenomenal. We're talking in terms of the southern end of the pier of about £650,000. This is something which is quite impossible for us to stand on any sort of commercially viable end product. We couldn't make it pay at all.
But there was massive opposition to this plan, including celebrities such as Sir John Betjeman.
I don't think anyone in their senses would remove the pier for the following reasons. One, that the more roads become congested and smelly with traffic, the more important it is to be able to get some fresh air. The West Pier is now older than the present Palace Pier, and it has a very elegant outline on the skyline.
When the pier was eventually closed on health and safety grounds, the government placed preservation orders on it, eventually making it the first Grade 1 listed pier in Britain, marking it as significant an architectural monument as the Royal Pavilion, the Tower of London, or even St Paul's Cathedral, and preventing any form of demolition without parliamentary consent. Sadly, however, there was no government money for renovation. In 1978, the West Pier Trust was set up as a pressure group for supporters of the pier. And since AVP's redevelopment plans had been scuppered by local opposition and the costs of maintenance, the pier was sold to the Trust. Local historian Fred Gray.
The pier closed in 1975, and I think it could easily have been pulled down, but it was down to a number of people. The most important one, I think, was John Lloyd, who set about campaigning for the pier. It was John, with friends of his, who ran the We Want the West Pier campaign, organised marches up and down the seafront, people writing into the council, a whole series of letter writing to the Times and to the local press and so on. And so John was a key influential figure in terms of keeping the pier.
We'll be treated with more respect now. We'll have more credibility. You know, people will realise that they've got to treat with us seriously, and we can effectively protect it now, I believe. And we will restore it meticulously using original materials wherever possible to what it used to be.
You just said we will restore it. No ifs, no buts. We will restore it.
No, there's no ifs as far as I'm concerned. But, of course, that's natural that I should feel that. I mean, I agree with the fortune teller at the very beginning of the campaign, who told me that it would be saved. I mean, I didn't know where she got her information from, but I think she's right. And she used to have a booth on the West Pier, so she ought to know.
Unfortunately, the 1987 hurricane ended John Lloyd's grand plan, as a central section of the pier started to collapse and was dismantled for safety. Ill health prevented him continuing at the Trust, so the campaigning continued under the leadership of his friend Brian Spielman. But many still thought the whole West Pier project was just a waste of time and public money. People such as John Blackman, a local businessman and former mayor of the town.
This long ongoing saga started in 1972, and it was then that we were faced with possible public funds being expended on it, and I was horrified, and that was my solution.
What we should say is that the West Pier is an amputated pier. It's one of the piers in Britain that doesn't actually reach the land. Nobody can get to it. It's been ruined by the 1987 gales. Now, Brian Spielman from the West Pier Trust, you're not going to let this happen, are you?
No, because, in fact, both of you have been talking absolute poppycock. There is only a small part that's missing, and it's not been demolished. It's been dismantled. We've got it in store, and it's going to be resurrected. Part of the restoration has begun. If you look, you will see the great West Pier sign is alight. We restored that this year. We have a £15 million project. We have a whole business plan to get the money. And we have a plan to get this job completed, fully open and fully working by the end of the century. We have worked the whole thing out, and we are at the moment on target. We turned this thing around last year. Mr. Blackman here has obviously not even been reading his local paper, so
yes, he doesn't know
what's been going on.
I do know what's been going on.
And we now have very good relations with the council and the government, such as has never happened before. We've turned all that round, and it's a collaborative effort.
The 1990s saw a shift in public priorities. The introduction of the National Lottery ensured that large new sums of money were available for significant cultural projects like the West Pier. The West Pier Trust secured significant funding and support from English Heritage and the National Heritage Memorial Fund. This paid for a section of the Landward decking to be repaired. And I'm proud to say that the pier otters helped to cut the ribbon at the opening ceremony. Jeff Mead was one of the tour guides at that time.
Even though I did it for 5 years, every time I went on, somebody would see something different and said, "Have you noticed that?" And I'd say, "No." There was so much beautiful classical heads, beautiful banded woodwork. Well, I suppose you'd call it distressed woodwork these days, peeling paint, lots of different layers. And we went out on a suspended steel gantry that led you out over the waves, right to the end of the pier, this beautiful curved pavilion at the end, which is as far south as you could go. And this gantry would go through and into the concert hall. And as you go in, everyone would just go, "Oh," because it's the most fabulous building, this great arch structure. It's rather like the inside of an Easter egg, this great turtle shell with big steel girders, completely over-engineered. I mean, I took some engineers on there, and they said, "There's about three times as much steel as you should possibly want to use for this." I said, "Well, that's why it's steel here." But the thing would be full of starlings and pigeons. And so you clap hands and they go mad, these pigeons, and fly out everywhere. And then it would hit you, the smell, because there's like 30 years of accumulated bird guano. And then we walk through this walkway, along this walkway, suspended above the deck, through and out the far side of the concert hall. And then you get a picture of the theatre at the far end. And that was very eerie, because the lower floor of what had been the theatre in the 1950s was turned into Laughterland, like a hall of mirrors. And you still have these ghostly images on the wall of, you know, clowns and notices. And then you go up some winding stairs to the first floor of what was the Ocean Restaurant. And again, there'd just be gasps, because huge open space. And some parts of the pier structure had been removed, the 1940s plasterboard, and underneath you could see the columns of the Victorian Theatre, red paint, cream paint, gold leaf, absolutely gorgeous. And everybody in the 5 years I did it, I never had a single person who said, "Whoa, total waste of money, give me my money back."
Around this time, Thor McIntyre Burney recorded the starlings in the concert hall. A strange, evocative sound and sight that added to the mystery, decay and evolution of the pier in its last stages.
It seemed like a really important time to go in and capture where it had got to at this point and how it's kind of naturally evolved over the last 30 years of being, since it was closed, I think, in the 70s. And it was really quite interesting the way the starlings had become the kind of new occupants, and also how the pier had turned into this sunset performance, and that every sunset you had these kind of audience that would come down to watch the starlings fly above the pier. And so I just really liked the way that the pier had sort of, although it's slowly sliding from land and humans' control into the sea, becoming more and more sort of overgrown, and it was also becoming stronger and stronger as a form of public art in a way. But there was a beauty in the fact that it wasn't contrived and it wasn't created to be that way, it just evolved into that.
The weather, procrastination and political neglect of the last 30 years means that now there's little left of this queen of piers. What treasures remain are held in safekeeping in a storeroom beneath the one bit of decking that survives.
It's all a bit gloomy in here, yeah. And very echoey, but I think. But
that's the Ocean Restaurant. That was the big restaurant, which was the top floor of the pavilion at the far end of the pier, which in its heyday was a massively popular restaurant.
Yeah.
That's the Ocean Restaurant sign.
I think when I last went on the pier, I managed to get a little piece of saucer or something that had been left out, because they were all left out. Yes. There's one here that says, what does it say? It says, psychometry, astrology and psychology. So someone was on there doing kind of all these new age
new
things.
Age things, yes,
Well, it must have been 1970s, I guess. I can't see what the final word is. It's a high water, so presumably that's when a high tide would have been. And then I just can't. Below it says pier.
Just put that next, see if I can.
Pier open. It's the opening times of the pier, that's what it is. I remember I went out onto the pier just before the storm, and we had to be terribly careful because right at the end, a lot of the decking was green and rotten.
Yes.
But one of the kiosks had just plummeted straight through and gone through the boarding into the sea below.
Yeah, now that's why we were keen to get off as much as we could. And of course, as history has shown, we were right to do it, because otherwise it would have been lost. There's still a lot on the seabed.
Yeah.
But as you can see, there's a massive store. And in terms of putting sufficient original artifacts back on to whatever kind of pier it is to justify the heritage element, there's no problem at all.
The Heritage Lottery Fund were also convinced that the West Pier could be restored to its 1920s splendour, for which they finally awarded the Trust a grant of £14.2 million in 1998. There was a real glimmer of hope as plans evolved to rebuild the pier, but vandalism, delays in funding, tempestuous storms and a series of legal objections to the West Pier's new planning proposals from its old rivals meant that the renovation work was constantly postponed. This grand old lady had already begun to collapse, and then in 2003 came the arson attack, which reduced her to the crumpled iron skeleton that remains today.
It was quite simply an untouchable inferno. 100 yards off Brighton Beach, one of the city's finest structures was in danger of total destruction with emergency services powerless to prevent it.
Who would do such a thing? A drunk? An irate local resident? Whoever it was, they wrecked the restoration plans.
Looking at it now, and you can see the smoke still rising, it's still far too hot for them to get on board and start looking at the causes of the fire, but that cooling down process might just preserve some of that elaborate ironwork.
A freak summer storm in 2004 saw the concert hall finally subside beneath the waves, and then the Heritage Lottery Fund withdrew its money, saying that the restoration was no longer viable. But that isn't what was said when the Fenice in Venice was rebuilt from scratch, or when the key landmarks of bombed-out European cities such as Krakow or Berlin were replaced. Why is the West Pier any different? This is what Dr. Andy Brown, the South East Regional Director of English Heritage, had to say.
This is a debate about authenticity and where the balance is between having to replace parts of something like a pier and the point at which it becomes a new pier and has no heritage value, is a new monument, a new building. And it was always going to be a difficult balance for us to draw. We felt that whilst the majority of the original pier or its direct successors, and whilst that process was a continuous process, it was still possible to view it as a Grade 1 historic building. What we would be facing now would be a completely new building. There's nothing left that you could rebuild that originates really with the original pier, apart from that little kiosk which has somehow survived the ravages of time and sits there as a little defiant structure. And the point at which we would have been putting lots and lots of public money, seriously big amounts of public money, into a new pier and trying to persuade everybody that it was the old pier was reached in the storm last year, and that was the point where we got past the point of no return. What we could do now would be simply to build a new pier, and that's not where English Heritage comes from. It may be a fine and laudable project for somebody else to take on, but £20 million and more of public money is actually much better spent in other parts of the heritage rather than building a new pier at Brighton.
Today, all around me here, there are red signs attached to many of the West Pier's tall piles saying, "Danger, keep away." A cruel irony for an attraction whose sole purpose for over 100 years was to attract and inspire. Eugenius Birch's grand folly is almost played out. How iconic. For the 21st century to allow the People's Palace to be washed away into oblivion. Or maybe it could be the touchstone for the future. I like to think so. Inspired by Birch, a new floating People's Palace could stand as a testament for another generation's social planning, engineering innovations, and cultural aspirations. In which case, we could allow the old pier to sink and rot, along with the fantasies, political inertia, and petty rivalries of the past. That was Oh What a Lovely Pier, which was first broadcast in 2005. From where I'm standing here on the beach, you can see that the dear old West Pier has become even more dilapidated. Then there were some vestiges of the superstructure left. But now all that remains is a tracery of ironwork, like the gossamer veins of a leaf in autumn, whose framework supported its summer glory. You've been listening to 4 Extra at the British Seaside, in which I've been delving into the wealth of archives at the BBC, which has triggered many memories for me and my guests about our love for the seaside and its entertainments. I hope you've enjoyed them too. I'm Tony Liddington. 4 Extra at the British Seaside was a peer production for BBC Radio 4 Extra, produced by Angela Hind.